Diane Coyle is our speaker. Diane is the Professor of Economics at the University of Manchester. She's also a fellow at the ONS and is particularly interested in the measurement, how we measure the modern economy, and in fact whether we are getting it right or indeed whether we are getting it more wrong. She's also the former chair, or vice chair, sorry, of the BBC Trust, but has told me that she's not prepared to take any questions on issues related to pay, is apparently what I've been rightly told. So there'll be no questions on BBC pay and whether people are overpaid or not, but she was former vice chair of the BBC Trust, indeed. She's also a prolific writer. Many of you will know she's written countless books on issues related to the economy. A fantastic homage, really, to GDP, the history of GDP, where it came from, where it is, and indeed where it's going. I strongly advise you, if you haven't read that, to find it in your local bookstore, in your local library, and have a read of it. Without further ado, Diane, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. So, good evening, everyone. I'm very impressed, not only by the turnout, which is fabulous, but also by the fact that you filled in from the front row, which is obviously the opposite of what my students do. This is going to be a game of two halves, really. I'm going to talk about industrial strategy in general, and then I'm going to take it to places and cities in particular. And the reason for the topic is that I'm a member of the Industrial Strategy Commission, independent body, chaired by Dame Kate Barker and supported by the Universities of Manchester and Sheffield. And we published a week ago our kind of interim findings, it's this fabulous document, Laying the Foundations, so you can download that and read it later if you want to. And the reason for setting up the commission was that Theresa May gave a speech when she became Prime Minister that seemed to open up a window of opportunity to talk in a cross-party way about industrial strategy for the first time properly in a generation. Because, of course, there had been industrial policies. Peter Mandelson had an industrial policy. Vince Cable had an industrial policy. And there were some useful things that came out of those. But for a generation in this country, we've had this idea that you can't talk about an industrial strategy or policy in a systemic way, because we tried that and it failed. It was all about picking winners, and why would you want to make the same mistakes again? And we've had that generation of policymakers, officials in Whitehall, politicians, who have thought in a very narrow and actually not very strategic way about government intervention in the economy. And that was the opportunity that we wanted to address, because we all think that there are ways of improving government's interaction with the private sector to bring about higher productivity, which is a way of saying higher living standards for people. And they haven't gone up for a decade now, so this is a challenge. And of course, the government brought out its green paper in March. And we responded to that. We've got our emerging findings. We're working towards a final report in mid-October. And I'm kind of unashamedly looking for ideas and feedback from all of you as well, because there are some things that are still open in our minds about what we should recommend. But why do we think we need one? Why do we think we need an industrial strategy? We've not had one since NEDI. Some of you here will remember that. It was put on death row by Mrs. Thatcher in 1979 and finally put out of its misery in 1982. And we've had other policies, but no joining up. And I think it's very clear, if you look at the statistics, that that has failed, that not thinking about government policy in a systemic way has failed. So this is going to work. This is a diagram that shows you labour productivity, output, GDP per hour worked in the G7 countries, all relative to the average of the G7. So that thick black line in the middle is the average. And the UK is the red line near the bottom. So it's not the very bottom, that's Japan. It's not the only one to show a decline. Italy's looking pretty bad, and actually Canada is looking surprisingly bad as well. But what you have in the case of the UK is a systematic underperformance compared to G7 average. It's about a 20% gap. And if you look at near neighbours and very similar economies like Germany and France, you'd want to understand what reasons there are that over this period, which goes back to 1970 in this chart, why have we not been able to match the G7 average? So there's that basic question. And as well as the levels question, you can see from the chart as well that there's this sort of dip post-financial crisis that people describe as the productivity puzzle. And the UK is not the only country to have been experiencing that. A number of the others have as well. But we've had this flat lining for reasons that economists can't pin down to any single factor. So that's the basic problem, and it matters because productivity isn't just something that keeps economists happy. It is about how you finance higher living standards for people over time, how you bring about progress in the economy. So that's one bit of evidence that what we've had hasn't actually worked. The next bit is skills, and this is an old story in the UK economy. What I've got here is a chart showing you from the Office for National Statistics the proportion of the workforce that's considered to be overeducated and the proportion that's considered to be undereducated. So the orange line shows you, it's a measure of skills at the bottom end of the labour market, and the blue line is graduate degrees. So the striking thing about this chart is the increase in that blue line from around 2006. The proportion of graduates who are working in jobs for which they're overqualified, for which they didn't need to have their degree, has gone up. And that tells you something that's a bit worrying, not only for the individuals whose hopes have been disappointed in some way, but also about the state of the labour market. And why aren't employers demanding that labour that's been trained to this high level of skill? Why aren't the jobs there? And then on middling skills and low skills, we have a cohort problem because young people in the 15 to 25 kind of cohort, for the first time, are not better educated than older workers. So we're not seeing progression over time in the level of skills in the economy. My screen here, it might look a big screen. And we have this long-standing problem about sort of technical skills and vocational skills as well. And one of the really shocking facts that was uncovered by my colleague Andy Westwood in Manchester in doing the research for this is that in the past 40 years, since 1980, 40 or so years, there have been now 29 major changes in policy towards further education, and 48 secretaries of state with lead responsibility for, ministers with lead responsibility for further education. So we're not taking that kind of cohort of people seriously. We are really messing them around. And this is an area of policy that's not joined up with either schools or higher education, or for that matter, the labour market. And if you talk to employers, they will often tell you that they don't have any influence over the kinds of skills that come out from further education colleges in their area. And it's an area where we think the devolution of skills to different economic regions, city regions or other kinds of entities, is important to get that kind of local knowledge about what skills are actually going to be needed in an area, and having that joining up with the labour market, as well as with higher education institutes, and as well as with sixth forms and schools. That's pretty shocking. And a very good example of the kind of policy turmoil in lots of areas of economic policy over the years. The next bit of evidence is about the trade deficit. It's not good. This is both the trade and the current account deficit, and you see that it's been pretty persistent since the mid-1990s and getting bigger. Now, the corresponding phenomenon to a current account deficit is a capital account surplus. They have to balance the balance of payments balances. And a capital account surplus means that people are investing. So the way we're paying for the deficit is that investors are putting money into the country. And some of that will be short-term and some of it will be longer-term. But to the extent that it's short-term money that's coming in and funding that growing deficit, it can go away again very quickly. And there's a sense in which, given the scale of this, this island is a floating hedge fund. In the context of Brexit and all the turmoil that will bring, that's a little bit worrying. So it's a problem in itself. It says that the goods and services that we produce, people don't want to buy them. We can only afford our level of consumption by having investors give us the money, lend us the money to do it. And the increase in recent times looks like it's unsustainable. And one of the key rules in economics is that things that are unsustainable don't get sustained. And very often, the way they are not sustained is a very uncomfortable transition. So that's a bit worrying as well. And then finally, well, actually, there's a long list of weaknesses. weaknesses. I could go on and tell you more, but the other one I want to focus on is regional inequality. These are Eurostat figures, and they, on each line, give you the purchasing power, its household income, for the different regions in each country. And who can guess which one is the UK? The labels are too small to read from where you're sitting, but the UK is by quite a long way the most regionally unequal country in the EU28. The one that comes closest is France, it's the next biggest bar, and it's another very centralised polity, but most of the European countries and the United States as well are much less regionally unequal than we are. Now, I would argue that that regional inequality is part of the productivity problem. If you want to increase national productivity levels, you need to have growth where there is headroom. If you're concentrating on London, if you're relying on the engine of London to grow your economy, and it has done fantastically well, then you're going to hit the capacity bottleneck faster than if you can get other cities in the economy to grow too. And if we can achieve that and get those other engines running, then we have a way to address the national productivity problem, as well as just the unfairness and the political tensions that come about from having that kind of regional inequality. And it really is extraordinary. You know, this really is an outlier compared to other very similar economies to ours. So I've given you, and I'll just sum them up, a long list of what are the weaknesses, what might we try to address with some kind of economic strategy. Low productivity, and by the way, also low levels of investment, low levels of R&D spending compared to international comparators, the current account deficit, the skills mismatches, which occur at a really granular level. One of the real puzzles is that we have quite a successful digital sector, which is crying out for people with skills. We've also got a lot of computer science graduates, and they've got one of the highest unemployment rates among groups of graduates. So there's some terrible mismatch going on there too. We know that living standards haven't gone up for 10 years, and that's linked to the productivity puzzle. We have a long tail of businesses that are less productive than the frontier. And all countries have a distribution, but our long tail is longer than most. And we've got this problem of that being very centralised and very, very regionally unequal. And all of these are linked to each other. And it's another argument for thinking about these in some kind of more strategic way. Because if you just pick one, if you just say, well, we're going to fix this bit of the skills problem, then you might be able to do much better by joining it up to some of the other issues here. Now, it's not that, and I should add, by the way, we do have Brexit. There's this huge uncertainty coming. There's even, I gather, uncertainty now about whether it will happen. I'm not politically astute enough to know whether that's just delusional thinking or not. A huge uncertainty, so all the more reason to find kind of homegrown ways to get the economy moving again. And a context of incredibly rapid change in global markets and in technologies. So in a lot of the areas where we have been doing incredibly well, there are new technologies that are disruptive. The auto sector is one example. Pharmaceuticals would be another example with new biotech, genetic techniques coming along. So we've got all of that to address. It isn't that there hasn't been government intervention in the economy. On the contrary, there's a ton of it, lots of it. Far too much of it in some ways, because it's changing all the time. But some of it has been very successful. And looking at the successes might give you some clues as to how to spread those more widely. And here are some of the bright spots. The first is pharmaceuticals, obviously. And we've got some world-leading companies in the UK. They do their R&D here. They've got a very highly skilled workforce. And they export a lot. So they contribute a lot to the positive side of the trade figures. They've had assistance through research funding in universities and through skills training for PhD students who work in their research labs, and also through tax incentives. The patent box, in particular, goes mainly to the pharmaceutical sector. So they've had quite a lot of government intervention to support that sector. My second example is the creative sector. We are particularly good at exporting television programs, radio programs, but also music, directors, writers, that the whole supply chain for that industry. And I would argue that the BBC has been a very successful industrial policy through two main means. One is that it does the skills training, not only for people in the BBC who then go on to work elsewhere, but through skill set for the industry as a whole. And as a purchaser of productions from independent companies, it has been a platform for a lot of indies and a lot of writers and directors to start their career in a guaranteed home market and then take it into export markets. It's true of music as well. We are one of the only countries, there are three countries in the world who are net exporters of music. Any guesses?
US.
US is one.
Korea.
Sweden is another, and the UK. I don't know whether Sweden is only ABBA or if there's more to it. Sweden is one of them. So that has been a kind of accidental industrial policy, and in fact, recent Conservative governments have been determined to attack the BBC and its purchasing power, I think without thinking through what the consequences might be. And of course, another interesting aspect was the decision to move a large chunk of the BBC to Salford, to Media City. And there's every sign that that has created a very successful creative industry cluster in the Northwest, because now other production companies and supply chain companies, special effects people, makeup people, are centered there as well. And if you were thinking about moving Channel 4, which the government is, it would seem to me to be madness to move it to Birmingham, where they don't have that supply chain and labor force, rather than moving it to Salford, Manchester, the Manchester area, where there is that kind of labor force. And people, you have the benefits of a thick labor market and the exchange of ideas, people all being in one place. There's very well-known clustering effects, which I'll say a bit more about later. So that's a sort of unintended industrial policy success. Then I've got the city. And if you think about it, the government has been incredibly faithful to the city in many ways. And an obvious way would be deregulation. And the regulatory framework in the UK is seen as a major contributor to its growth since the late 1970s. But also infrastructure, I would add in this context, because Canary Wharf is right there. It had the DLR, it had the Docklands Light Railway, it had the City Airport. The city as a whole has benefited from the planning regime and the Thames Link upgrade. So there's been a lot of infrastructure go into creating a financial services sector that can thrive, as well as the regulatory environment. And then finally, I've got here, this is my colleagues from Sheffield, the Advanced Manufacturing Research Centre established in the outskirts of Sheffield and Rotherham, which is a much more recent example of an intervention at a local level mainly that has been very successful and has done that matching between employers' demands for certain kinds of skills, the skills provision, the provision of the local infrastructure, and the buildings and roads to get there, and it's a very impressive place if you haven't visited it. And that seems to be thriving as well. So we do have examples of things that work, and we want to learn lessons from the ones that have worked so that we can make those more widespread. Now, one of the, I should add also, you could mention others. You could mention higher education, and people don't always think about that in that, this context, but it's another really successful export business, and we are world leaders in that. It's under some threat. Autos is another, where the initial decision to incentivize Toyota and Nissan to come into the Northeast actually really paid off big time. And it's a good example of picking a winner who was a winner rather than picking a winner who became a loser. And whenever people give you that accusation that industrial policy is only about picking winners and about to fail, actually, it does sometimes succeed in the public sector. And by the way, don't you know how often things fail in the private sector too, and we never hear about them. So thinking about what's gone wrong with policies in the past, I've already alluded to the fact that there are lots of changes and they haven't been quite joined up. But other things have gone wrong as well. There hasn't been a consensus. And I think we were quite distinctive in not having that political, non-partisan consensus that you need the government to take a strategic view of how it affects the economy. Even the United States has a consistent industrial policy. They don't call it that, they call it the defense budget. But that's what it is. And that's got cross-party consensus. We've had policy seesaws in these key areas. I talked about education, where it's not only FE, but primary education as well, now increasingly higher education, constant policy churn and change. Energy would be another example. The number of reforms to the energy market, the electricity market, that have taken place over the past 10 or 15 years has been quite extraordinary. We have departmental silos, and it's very Whitehall-centred, and quite a lot of the challenges require not only cross-department, but cross-levels of government joining up. And I'm going to come on to talk a bit about one example of how that joining up might work. There's been a focus on sectors, and we've seen that again with Mrs. May and her interventions, the letters to Nissan and Toyota, and this thinking about very traditional kinds of sector. I increasingly think the distinction between manufacturing and services isn't helpful at all. Industrial policy makes you think about trad manufacturing sectors like autos, but actually we're an 80% services economy, and we ought to be thinking about the health and social care sector and the export potential, or the professional services market and the threat to that from Brexit and other export potential there. But it's not only that. If you think about traditional sectors, you're missing out a whole swathe of supply chain providers who supply to different, quote, sectors. They might supply to aerospace and autos and food processing, for instance, depending on what their specialism is. So I think that sector focus isn't very helpful. And what's more, the technologies now are completely disrupting sectors. So the auto sector in 10 years' time will not be just the incumbents we have now, and will not be the supply chain that we have now. It will be manufacturers of electric vehicles, which might be incumbent car manufacturers, but might be others. And it will be a completely different supply chain, and it will have battery makers in it too. So thinking about not falling for those traditional sectors is important. And one of the tools that I think will be really a really important part of future industrial policy will be a focus on competition and making sure that it's possible for new entrants to come into markets, particularly where the technology is changing. But having a strong competition policy makes sure that you can diffuse new technologies and also protects against picking winners problem, actually, because it stops you favouring the incumbents and just channeling subsidies to those even if they're not very successful. And this point about not having a perspective on making and growing markets, because of the way, I guess, officials have been taught economics, if they're in their 40s and 50s now, and it was at that time a very free market focus, and the attention was all about identifying a particular market failure and fixing that, there's been much less thinking about how can you make or grow markets. Which new technologies might it be possible for British companies to reach viable scale and export, and what does government procurement do for that? My BBC example might fit into that. We could think about new kinds of special effects markets and using that purchasing power to grow those. We could think about health innovations and using the purchasing power of the NHS to grow those markets. And the last three items on this list about flawed decision making and neophilia and lists of policies without having a strategy. It's all a very polite way of saying that what politicians like to do is announce stuff. And so there's a constant flow of new things to be said, and some exciting new shiny technology to support, or rather than consolidating, changing things all the time. And this issue about how you combine a strategic view of managing the economy with the need to be politically responsive is one of the big institutional challenges, I think. I'm going to come back to that as well. So that's what's gone wrong. Why do we need it? Well, we can go back to basic economics again. And I like to do this because this is my day job. As I just said, it's often thought about in terms of market failures. But market failures aren't just the private sector isn't providing this thing that we think it ought to in a narrow area. It's a much broader set of categories than that. One of the most important things, I think, is coordinating activities, the convening power of government to get people together and agree on technical standards, for instance, so that you can get to economies of scale more quickly because everybody's producing to the same set of technical standards and competing on other attributes with whatever it is that they're making or selling. Or skills, how do you create consistent skills and how are they certificated so that employers know what they're getting when they hire somebody with a certain certificate. So there are lots of areas where coordination is really important. Pooling risk and creating markets and substituting for missing markets. All of this is referring to the kinds of area I was just talking about, where there may be a new technology or there may be a new market to capture, but anybody wanting to enter that market has to reach a certain minimum scale to be able to do it, or you have to persuade consumers that whatever this new thing is, it's something they're going to want to purchase, and the government can have an important role in that too. One example from my own experience was HD television, which people now take as a standard, but it was new only 6 or 7 years ago, and the rest of the industry was very keen for the BBC to launch the first HD channels because it would customise viewers to watching programmes in HD, and they all were able to roll out their own HD services on the back of that. Public goods is kind of obvious, and some of those are sort of obvious as well. Basic research is the one that leaps to mind, and there's a good evidence that the state funding research crowds in private sector research quite substantially. So if the government isn't spending enough, then the private sector won't be spending enough on it either, and both are true. Externalities would include things like climate change and what does the government need to do in the market to ensure that there's enough private investment to address those sorts of challenges. So all of this isn't really about, or isn't much about money, and often when you talk about industrial policies, people's minds go to what kind of tax breaks or subsidies do we need to give. I think even if there were no new money, we could do much better than we do now if we had this coordinated way of thinking about it and use the state's convening power in a more strategic way. So that's sort of generality. I've touched a little bit on places, but I want to talk about that more specifically now. And under these headings, and the first and most important is this agglomeration economies point, which I'm sure people in this room are really familiar with. And we're an urban society. Urbanisation is going to continue around the world, not just here. And agglomeration economies are both real and very powerful. And if you want your whole economy to succeed, you can't go against the grain of them. You have to work with them. And so that means acknowledging that you need to get the kind of labour markets where people have confidence that they can get another job if they want to leave their old one, where employers will come in because they're confident that they can find the skills that they need in a certain area. And this has to be at a sufficient level of granularity. It isn't enough to say, oh, it'll be biotech. It's much more specific than that. And I think we lack the information, or at least we lack the information centrally about what different cities are good at that level of detail. And one of the really striking things about the data we have on regional economies and city economies is how sparse it is, certainly compared to other economies, which is very telling because statistics, the etymology of the word is state, and statistics are the figures that the state collects to inform its policies. And our state hasn't collected figures on subnational places, anything like other countries do, and all of these issues about place have been largely invisible to the government because they don't have the statistics on it. So one of our big recommendations is going to be ensuring that we have a proper statistical foundation for the cities and other geographical divisions of the country to take their destiny in their own hands and boost their economies. And as I said earlier, fighting agglomeration economies is really stupid, and it's something that governments attempt to do all the time. Jam spreading, because one place has something, another place has to have something. I gave the creative sector example. My colleague Richard Jones from Sheffield likes to give the nanotechnology example. He's a nanotechnologist. The government put a big chunk of money into the technology a while ago in 28 different nanotechnology centres throughout the country, which is absolutely bananas. because you want to gather those scientists together in just a few places so that they can talk to each other and share ideas. It's madness to spread both the equipment and people over so many different centres. And this is always a big temptation for government. I'm going to come back to appraisal methods. I want to spend a bit of time on that. The zero-sum mentality really bugs me. People talk all the time about rebalancing the economy, and I fall into it myself. And that's a reflection of the idea that there's only a certain amount of growth to spread around, which is complete nonsense. And nobody wants London to be less successful. We want other places to become more successful, and it isn't a zero-sum game. In fact, it would benefit all if other cities could grow faster and have higher productivity levels as well, and be more specialised. London can specialise in finance and professional services, and other cities can specialise in other things. The centralisation I've talked about already, we do have a very highly centralised polity. The point about second tier and beyond, it's about cities that are not going to be global centres of anything, and also about the towns in those city regions that are struggling, the Burnleys and the Oldhams near my city, and what to do about those. And this regional division problem that I talked about at a kind of national scale is fractal. It applies in all the city regions as well. And it's something to really worry about. It's obviously part of what has played into the discontent that has had political manifestations recently. And I used to think that the problem is about people and not places. And that if you gave people what they needed to get on, and therefore focused on education, say, then over the long term, some of these economic problems would work themselves out. And I've now changed my mind, and I think it's about places and not people. And that's partly because people don't want to leave places on the whole. Most people are not mobile. And it's also because there are things that you can't do as an individual that need to be done collectively. And I would now argue for universal basic infrastructure. There's a lot of talk about universal basic income, but that has the same flaw. If you have an income, that's really good, but there are lots of things that you can't do with your own income. You can't build yourself a better tram line or bus route into the city where you might get a job. You can't, with your own income, make your children's school much better. Some of those things have to be provided collectively. So I would now argue that for all places in the country, for all the towns and the second tier cities, there needs to be a level of universal basic provision of both hard and soft infrastructure, the broadband, the transport networks, the community networks, but also the soft infrastructure of hospitals and schools. And that, I think, is the only possible way of addressing this tension about the power of agglomeration economies, meaning that productivity and jobs and investment will be concentrated in major cities, and the inequalities that seems to generate and the tensions that seems to generate. I want to go back to appraisal methods. And mostly it's done by looking at Treasury Green Book and cost-benefit analysis methods in there. This is highly economist-approved. And it obviously has merit to try and find some evidence about which investments you should undertake and which you shouldn't. When you look at big decisions about HS2 or other bits of infrastructure, you strongly get the impression that the decision was taken and cost-benefit analysis was fitted to justify the decision. And if you're making that kind of judgment, then you need to be explicit about it. And there might be reasons for imposing political or other kinds of judgment, non-monetary judgments on an investment decision. But more importantly, what it does is it rewards the places that are already successful. Because in a cost-benefit analysis, you project out what you think the costs are going to be, the investment costs and the running costs, and that's reasonably straightforward. And then you try to project what the benefits will be. And that's much harder. You've got to predict demand or maybe passenger numbers. You try to think about environmental impacts and wider impacts. But the values that you plug into your estimates are current wage rates or land values or productivity levels. And any place that becomes a little bit more successful than others is always going to look better in cost-benefit analyses than the ones that were lower ranked the last time around. So it's what is called in sociology the Matthew effect, that to them that hath, shall will be given. And it operates really powerfully in infrastructure appraisals, I think. And so rethinking how we do those appraisals is very important. We heard, I think it was today, not yesterday, that the line between the rail line between Cardiff and Swansea is not going to get its upgrade, although it will get free Wi-Fi, so you'll still be slow, but at least you can be online. Here's the example of Crossrail 2 and the Northern Cities Crossrail. And Crossrail 2 does very well in its cost-benefit analysis, but it's an extra piece of infrastructure in an already incredibly dense transport network. And of course it's busy and more capacity would be great, but there's already people who live in and around London fantastic ways of getting into jobs in London. In those northern cities, it's getting much less money. It looked a much less compelling cost-benefit case. But if you think about the potential on wage rates and productivity of turning those northern cities into a single labour market, a single commuter market, well, that's quite big. And this doesn't need to be just hand-waving. You can be more systematic about it. You can say, what percentage increase in wage rates would need to plug into the benefits bit of the cost-benefit analysis to make this ratio look much better? And if it's 10%, that's quite reasonable, and if it's 150%, that's probably really not very sensible at all. So you can adjust how you do appraisals in a way that will rebalance the amount of infrastructure investment. I'm using that word again, it's really hard not to use it, change the ranking of your appraisals in projects like these. And this, I think, is going to be really important. So in our report, we've labelled, seven foundations for what a successful industrial strategy needs to look like. I think the hardest is the institutional framework. How do you get that balance between being strategic and being politically responsive and accountable? And our thinking at the moment is that industrial strategy needs to be owned in number 10 and number 11. It needs to be right at the heart of government. But it needs some kind of independent monitoring or evaluation. We'll try to think about metrics or ways of evaluating policies. And that should be located in an independent body. And the OBR might be a good parallel for how you think about doing that. Or maybe the National Audit Office or some independent body. The other, and I think this is linked to the next bullet point about place, industrial strategy is only going to succeed if it takes places seriously and takes agglomeration economies seriously and looks at increasing the economic success and productivity of the country's other cities apart from London. But finding how to incorporate that in your institutional framework, I think, is quite hard. There's no hard science about what decisions have to get taken at what level. And we've got this patchwork of geographies. We've got city regions, and we've got LETs, and we've got county councils, and some of these are more successful than others. So thinking through, both economically and politically, how to fit that into a framework that will be sustained is quite a challenge. And if anybody's got ideas about that, I'm really keen to hear them. The government has to invest in science and research and innovation. It has to do this also with an awareness of place, because just as infrastructure investment is very regionally uneven, so is investment in the science base. Competition policy, making sure that new firms, new productive firms, can get into the market, and that you are safeguarding against undue government support for firms that don't deserve it. And if that's... But that's going to come back from the EU, because a lot of state aid policy has been EU-run, so we need to replace that ourselves. More investment, and government investment will crowd in and not crowd out private sector investment largely. A consistent, joined-up, sustained skills policy to deliver the supply of skills, but also some thought about the demand for skills and that mismatch problem I talked about right at the start. Why are graduates finding jobs, only jobs that don't need graduate degrees? And then using the government's power to regulate markets and to, as a purchaser in areas such as health and social care and others, to create markets and grow them. So those are our foundations. And one of the ways of thinking about political responsiveness is that the challenges that industrial policy is responding to might change over time. So we had to go at thinking about what are the immediate challenges facing the economy. and came up with this list, that decarbonisation is a pretty obvious one. If you don't get to net emissions within a reasonable time frame, then there's no plateauing at all of global temperature increase. And obviously it's a global problem. Adequacy of the infrastructure. We are still using infrastructure that the Victorians built 150 years ago. And my goodness, how did they decide to build 150 years worth of capacity? And the rationale for HS2 is not that we need a fast journey to Birmingham and Manchester, it's that we need more capacity, but also parts of it were built in 1830, for goodness sake. Why would you not want to upgrade it? Health and social care is obviously a really pressing problem. Sort of, people find it counterintuitive to include this as an industrial strategy priority, but it's a big sector of the economy, and there are markets there. We could grow private sector providers in health and social care who would be able to export their business models to other countries, as well as deliver a better quality of care, probably at less cost in this country as well. Creating a better environment for long-term investment. This, I think, is tricky. The problem about financing investment and the role played by shareholder capitalism and the banks in the short-termism that is evident in the UK is again, something that's puzzled policymakers and economists since the 1930s, at least. And there, I think, again, there's not really good evidence about what things you could tweak to deliver more long-termism, but it's clearly important. Creating more high-value industries. We have some that are very high-value and world-leading, and I talked about pharmaceuticals earlier. Can we have more of those, please, and upgrade some of the industries that we have? And then, above all, having growth around the whole of the economy, because that's the only way that the national productivity levels and living standards around the country are going to improve. So, as I said, all of this is set out in the report that came out last week, and we're aiming to produce our final report in mid-October. So, over the summer, I'm going to be thinking about all of these points again. But obviously there are some really quite difficult open questions and some areas where we might say there's just more work to be done here, we don't know what the answer is, but here's what needs thinking about. But I'm going to stop there and turn to you, because I think a lot of you in the room will have useful things to tell me about all of this. Thanks very much.
It's James Stevens. I'm the director for Cities for the Homeless Coalition. Professor Cole, that's very interesting. You observe that we operate in a highly centralised polity. Can I ask, are you encouraged by the government's devolution agenda and the establishment of the combined authorities of their metro mayors? I'm not entirely convinced yet. But do you think it would be improved if you had what you described as a higher institutional framework, i.e. the leadership set by government?
Okay, so we'll just pause while you collect your thoughts on that, Dan, and we'll come back to that. So are we encouraged by the Devo agenda? It may not be perfect, but are we on the right road? Are we not concerned that we might introduce an institutional framework to crowd some of that out?
Three quick points. Industrial trade accords were abolished in the Thatcher government. Should they come back? Second point, a regulation. Obviously, we've seen a major failure of regulation affecting Kensington and Chelsea and residents there. Building control is important.
Yep.
I'll move on to the other part of regulation, planning control, and the issue of high-growth firms, the gazelles, as they're called. And doing some work around the M25, it's quite clear that a lot of the existing commercial floor space is being converted to housing. So one of the issues you haven't mentioned is the fact that government policy is constraining the growth of high-growth firms in the area around London.
OK. Thank you very much. And lady just behind you.
Thank you. I'm from South Cambridgeshire. Do you think there's any chance that the government's City Deals programme will actually be effective in addressing the regional inequalities you talked about?
OK. So we've got two... in the same sort of space, yeah, and then a couple on ITBs where they come back, but actually I think a bigger point around planning and the role of planning either as an enabler or more particularly a controller and an inhibitor of economic activity. Over to you.
I've been involved in Manchester since the Manchester Independent Economic Review in 2009. And if you talk to the people who were the main drivers behind that, people like Howard Bernstein and Richard Lees, they will tell you it's been a 25-year journey to get this far. So I am encouraged. I think it's the best opportunity that we've had that I can remember to halt and possibly reverse the centralisation, the economic and political centralisation of this country. And but it's not guaranteed to succeed, and it's not guaranteed to succeed in all the places that have it. And there are a number of issues. I think the main one is always political. There needs to be enough drive locally, and this is small p political. Enough people locally are willing to sit down and work together and coordinate and make something succeed. And that was the first thing that Howard and Richard pulled off in Greater Manchester, getting that kind of cooperation. And it hasn't worked, obviously, in all the places where the government's tried to establish the city deals. There's a question about capacity, and do you have people locally who can deliver the kinds of promises that ought to be devolved? And people worry about that. I worry a bit less because there are lots of economists around, there are lots of analysts around. They can move, and you can build up that capacity quite quickly, I think. I don't know what the right institutional framework is, and I don't know exactly what the relationship ought to be between the city mayors and the LEPs. This is sort of part of the patchwork problem that I was talking about. But at least we're talking about it. I don't know all the city regions as well as you guys will, but my sense is, from what I've spoken to, that they're determined to have a go, that they've got the deal and they're determined to have a go. So, of course, it might fail, but I do think it's the best opportunity that I can remember for this to happen. And given the challenges that we're facing, we've got to make it work. And actually, given that Whitehall is so distracted by Brexit at the moment, there's a lot of opportunity to just get them under the radar and do things, and that's quite encouraging as well. Industrial training boards, I doubt that reinventing exactly the same kind of thing that existed in the 1970s is quite right. But what you need, obviously, is to have some framework where employers can talk to education and skills providers, and that's been lacking. And it's happened in some places in an ad hoc way, but not in any formalised or institutional way. And so that, I think, would be the important thing to restore or retain in some way. Regulation and planning, these are really difficult questions, aren't they? I mean, I guess the regulation, it's a really good illustration of the need to join up different bits of regulation, because otherwise they compete against each other. And departments don't talk to each other. They just don't talk to each other. And you might find that the education department is completely resistant to talking to DCLG about how you might think about devolving further education policies. Or, building regulations people don't talk to environment people because they're in a different building. They really don't talk to each other. So finding some forum in which those conversations take place would be the main lesson that I would take away. And on the M25 and housing versus gazelles issue, that's just about London hitting the buffers faster than everywhere else. We know that London is too congested, that more people want to live here than can find housing here, so there's a huge pressure on housing demand. And one of the tricks will be finding things that attract gazelles to other places. Maybe it's further down the M4 corridor. Maybe they could even think about somewhere near Manchester Airport, which has more international destinations now than anywhere apart from Heathrow, I think. So, but asking what else is it that stops those kinds of companies from wanting to be in other places. And the clustering forces, the agglomeration forces, are very powerful. So it's quite hard to overturn being in London because everybody else is in London. But there are a few sectors and a few places where we have an opportunity now to make that happen.
Dan, just your reflection, because you said you started with this question about the legacy effect that industrial strategy in the 1970s has had and continues to play today. In a sense, I think there's a loss of confidence in government in that, because of those legacy issues, it stays away from some of the bigger questions and messes around with some of the smaller questions that don't really have any effect. Give me is that your sense? Do you think that they've lost that bit of confidence? And when we think about the questions and issues that you're outlining there, is this more likely to come from our cities and our city regions and the thinkers and the policymakers at that level rather than national government? Is that where we should look for?
I think you're right about the loss of confidence and the loss of the habit of thought. I think it will be politically led, because ultimately, if you're talking about government convening power and aligning policies, you're talking about somebody who's got a vision about where things are going to go and pointing everybody in the same direction. And the key person in that is the one who says, that's where we're going to go. And so that could be central government, it could be the Chancellor for political reasons, he wants us to succeed, or it could be some of the city mayors who do it, or it could be, you know, some Emmanuel Macron figure who comes from nowhere, it could be you.
I know my place. Let's take another round of questions. I'm going to go gentleman there, one right at the back. Just start there. We'll do the same again. Just make your point, and we'll collect the three, and I'll come to you in a second.
So you said there's a mismatch between graduates and jobs and being overqualified. Then recently in the Financial Times it said, you know, German and French politicians have a far more technical background, and in the UK they're typically from, you know, more classics or what have you, humanities. Do you think maybe we're training people fundamentally in the wrong thing, and that has legacy problems as well going forward? And that's part of your long-term strategy.
So good question. Do we need more technical skills and amongst our decision makers? Gentlemen, right at the back. Sorry, and then we'll come.
Hi, Kevin Johnson. I'm from a small place between here and Manchester called Birmingham. Given that Channel 4 is a publisher broadcaster rather than a full-scale producing house, and given the aged, historical, if you like, assets of broadcasting production in Birmingham and the West Midlands, given the creative and digital sector, just how mad would it be to move Channel 4 to Birmingham?
There we go.
So
you say
things,
and then people actually listen to what you say, and then come back and ask you a question. Yes, sir. Just say, get your question, and then we'll.
Yeah, it was indeed a very innovative and very competently prepared paper what you have presented. In a nutshell, I would like to say that in London, especially, the concentration of everything or the growth or everything is concentrated towards the London. So the government policy, and that's what, as an economist, what I always propose as an educationist, that the government should be working less towards the political correctness, because there are so many other fields they can continue to show their political correctness. But when it comes to the strict terms of industrial strategy commission or policy, it should be directly directed only towards that particular thing. The political correctness, those things, should be, it should be a political matter, if I am able to express my views. For example, I'll tell you, because since I cannot comment on other strategy formulations for the industries, because other industries I do not have much to say. But education is an industry, I can say. The demand for education, that is UK education, demand for UK education world over is so high. Perhaps you not have understood that particular people, those who are policy making, they have not understood that word. I hear from the country, that is India, and we are running our education policies for many, many countries now. We are already planning. Everywhere we go, the demand for the UK education is so high. So my point is, as an export for the education, your competency and education, if you are just concentrating and opening certain centers in those countries, immediately your export increases to a great extent. Yeah. And your concentration, education in UK is political correctness, it is more linked with the immigration. The moment the immigration is stopped, then your education policy immediately changes.
Okay. Very
so
good.
That need be correct.
So we've got this mismatch. Do we not train off decision makers, never mind anyone else, in regards to technical skills? I think that was the point there. Channel 4 to Birmingham, is it really that mad from a person that lives in Birmingham, by the way? I didn't say that. And, you know, we've got some real export strengths. You know, should we be more focused on those in an industrial strategy moving forward?
There are sort of two bits to your questions about graduates and jobs. And the overqualification bit, the puzzle there is why employers aren't demanding higher skilled labour. And I think that's linked to underinvestment, because there's a really strong correlation between investment in new technologies and the employment of more skilled people and the wages then that you pay those people. So I think they're linked, and we need to look at the labour demand side of that to kind of address that puzzle. Should politicians have more technical backgrounds? I do think we have a surfeit of historians and physicists. We probably have not in the past. I think it's changed considerably, but in that generation we probably weren't educating enough scientists and technologists. Scientists may be too sensible to want to go into UK politics, I don't know. But the broader issue is just that set of technical skills which are under-respected. They're thought of as low skills and only quite high skills. It's the poor relation in terms of funding to higher education, and we need to concentrate on it more, have more consistent policies, put more funding in it compared to higher education. I'll stop at that. I do think it would be crazy to move Channel 4 as a whole to Birmingham, and I'll try and justify it. It's absolutely true that Birmingham has some key creative skills. They're less in the straight broadcast, they're more in the digital online stuff, and that's fantastic. The key about making it succeed as a global sector is agglomeration. And I just don't see why you would dilute that if you put it all in the same place. Because it's about having a labour market all in the same place, and there's exchange of skills all in the same place, and investors know that it's there, and the supply chain builds up in the same place. So I'm sorry that we put the BBC North in Salford and not in Birmingham, but I think given that it's there, and given that it started to create that clustering effect, not encouraging that, I think, would be a missed opportunity. And I think it would be better for Channel 4, for the people. The opportunities that those people who relocate would have would be much richer if they're in a bigger centre. And there are lots of other things that Birmingham is terrific at doing, including all of those other digital productions. So I'm going to stick to that, I'm afraid.
Would that have not been the argument to keep it in London?
Yeah, it would. Yes, I agree, and that's a good point. So the question there is, do you only want one of these, or do you want two or three of these? And that takes you back to my argument about things hitting the buffers so quickly in London. It's already the case that it's quite hard for broadcasters to hire people at junior levels in London because they can't afford anywhere to live. So it obviously makes sense to try and expand that into a second centre. So given that you're already pretty full up in the one place, and that everywhere else in the world, in any sector, will have more than one centre, we'd have two or three, then that would be the answer to that question. But it was a good question. Higher education is a great export sector. Nobody understands why the Prime Minister, and it is her alone, insists on keeping international students in the immigration total. Nobody understands it. It's complete madness, and it's going to do great damage to the sector.
I'm sure it might become clear in a couple of years when she writes her memoirs. It might become clear as to why she's stuck with that. This is the last run, so I'm going to be... If people can promise to be quick, you've had your hand up. I'm going to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So 5 questions, nice and sharp, otherwise I will be here all night. Nice and quick, yes. Not a point, a question, so yes. Diane can respond. That will be lovely. Go on.
Terence Bendixson, University of Southampton. You made a point about America having an industrial policy, its defence policy. We have a successful army and navy here, and indeed in the 19th century, the navy was our industrial policy. Might you during the summer ponder whether we should support the military and our defence as an aspect of your regeneration ideas?
Very good. Okay. Ladies, straight behind you. Yeah.
Hi, Rosalind Redhill from BAM, privatecarsinlondon.com. I just wanted to talk about carbon tax, looking at things through carbon tax, which, you know, for the countries that will be, you know, making sure that their products and their services are low carbon, they may not want to buy from, you know, countries that aren't doing that, and also whether the prevention of ill health, which would make savings by putting in active travel infrastructure, and the fact that we import 80% of our vegetables. These are low-tech but very important ways of growing our industry.
Okay, very good. Gentleman there.
Hi there, I'm on a consultancy called Global Cities. You talked very clearly about where those aspects of our economy are that are successful, that have got an internationalised or an export ability that will fit into a globalised economy. Despite the fact that we're talking about the problems in our cities, is there not also a converse case to talk about where there is success within our cities? So you talked about health, decarbonisation, all of education as having a global offer. Is there not something which we do have a successful in agglomeration economies here that is highly exportable and highly exportable to a world that's urbanising, that we need to find mechanisms to help to support the bits that are good and that do work? Because there's a tremendous demand, certainly from my own experience, where people want to come here to learn from people at the centre of the cities about how we do it well.
You're very kind.
Yeah. Hi there, my name is Jennifer Angus. I work for Lambeth Council. I'm just wondering what the smallest scale you think clustering can work at. So, for example, can it work in a small town centre across a couple of buildings, or does it need to be bigger?
Oh, that's
it.
Yeah, and then we've got the one there.
It's Linda McDermott from the COP Party. The COP Party has recently published a document called Six Steps to Build Community Wealth. And it's based on the sort of procurement that you talked about, keeping local procurement from local organisations in the community. There are examples in Preston, Manchester and Leeds. Have you seen these examples of this, and do you think it is a good way forward and it could maybe address the issue of the person before me? Thank you.
Right. Have you made a note of them? Should we compare notes?
I've got a note.
Defence.
I think that's a really interesting point. The focus on so much government procurement, and I think it's true in defence as well, has been keeping the cost down to the point that things might not work properly in the end. Thinking about using any kind of government procurement, not only to be able to shoot missiles at people or whatever they do, but as a way of embedding particular skills, is, I think, a really important. If you're going to have a defence sector, it might as well be delivering that as well as the missiles. I think that's a good point. Carbon tax. I am in favour of carbon tax. I think it's actually helpful to industry. They don't. I think it's helpful because in the past, when the oil price has gone up dramatically, it has led to great efficiencies in industry because it's been forced on them and innovations. So it's a very painful way of driving innovation. But I think, given the global challenge of climate change, it would be a very sensible way to do it. You won't find many energy-intensive industries agreeing about that, I have to say. Next one's about growing...
So Dave's point about we see good things in our places,
yeah.
And other countries or other cities across the globe see good things in our cities. You know, maybe there's an export opportunity there, and how we can encourage more of that learning and exchange.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, generally, between cities, but also there are millions and millions. There are lots of sources of government advice and sources of government funding, and there are different schemes and different sources of information, and some of that's local and some of that's national. I think creating a kind of one-stop shop where people can just find what's available to them. Do they need a grant? Do they need to find an investor? Do they need to find examples of good management practice? Some way of sharing that those lessons would be really useful. There's a kind of model in Ireland where they put all of those together in one development body. So that's where you go if you want information or you want to find a training course to improve your quality of management. And maybe this is too big an economy to have it in just one place, but certainly consolidating what there is and finding a way of sharing those lessons, I think, is really important. And to segue into the next question, which is yours, Jennifer, I think they can be quite small. And it depends on the economies of scale and the minimum viable scale in the activity that you're talking about. But some of these can be quite small, I think, or they can start quite small. Kate Barker, who chairs the commission, is from Stoke, which is not a thriving place. But she visits a lot and has discovered that the art scene there is starting to grow because it's cheap. So artists are priced out of other cities are going to Stoke. And it has a long heritage of design. And so there's something there that could be seeded into a success story that can grow over time. So they can start small, and they might stay small, but what you need to keep an eye on is the dynamics and the economies of scale in that particular activity. But although I was talking about the big ones and the export challenges, because my goodness, have we got an export challenge facing us? I think you're right to highlight the small ones as well. And then the co-op example, I think, is a good example both of operating at different scales, but also using procurement sensibly. And you can think of things where public bodies could procure at a smaller scale from smaller suppliers. In cities, it might be something like social care, which is an inherently small-scale activity. It's very labour-intensive, and it's always going to be, unless the robots really get much better. And so if you can manage that process, then that'd be viable at small scale. I think the management of the process is the difficult bit, because the capacity to do that kind of procurement in a lot of public sectors isn't there at the moment.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. So I think it's always good in an event where you feel that you could go on, and I know there were more questions, so I apologise for not getting you in. So this concludes, I suppose, the formal bit of the lecture. Please, you can join with us and come outside and have a glass of wine or a glass of juice and carry on the conversations. But thank you all again for coming, and can you join me to thank Diane for a fantastic...